Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says more federal help could be on the way for the state of Illinois, but not, as one state leader recently asked, to backstop underfunded government pensions.
For us to suggest that the help from the federal government would be used for pension relief is going nowhere in Washington. In fact, it's going to be used against us.
We'll talk to Senator Durbin this hour. Then, how have you been sleeping during the pandemic? A lot of people are reporting unusually vivid dreams. We'll talk to an expert about the importance of sleep and why many of us might be experiencing COVID dreams. And we'll talk with Illinois booksellers about what they're reading now and how their businesses are adapting to the stay-at-home order. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Case reports of COVID-19 continue to be on a plateau in Illinois. There were nearly 2,300 confirmed cases announced yesterday and another 136 deaths. Meanwhile, clusters also continue to be identified in places where people live or work in tight quarters, like nursing homes and like meat processing plants. That last one is of particular interest to my first guest today, Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. He helped pay for college by working at a pork processing plant in East St. Louis. Durbin's in Washington this week, where the Senate is meeting, and that's where I connected with him earlier this morning.
All right, Brian, I have Senator Durbin on the line.
Okay.
Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Senator. How are you?
I'm fine. How you doing?
You know, it's a beautiful sunny day here in Springfield, so I can't really complain.
Good. A little chilly, I understand.
We had a wide-ranging conversation about meatpacking facilities, the fight over when and where to reopen businesses in Illinois, and the sexual assault allegations against presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. But first, we've known for some time now that people who are African-American are more likely to be afflicted and killed by the novel coronavirus. In Chicago, less than a third of the population is black, but they've accounted for 70% of the deaths from COVID-19. And now there are new reports that Latino communities are also seeing higher case totals. I began by asking Senator Durbin what he's doing to address these disparities.
I had this conversation with Governor Pritzker a few weeks ago. We were one of the first parts of America to really collect data on racial background when it came to these coronavirus infections and deaths. So what we're trying to do is to collect the data nationwide. There's more and more evidence that we're not unique, that this is a phenomenon which is really deadly for minority populations, especially African-Americans and Hispanics. What we need to do, obviously, is to make sure that we have outreach in this area. I talked to Dr. Redfield with the Center for Disease Control yesterday. We need health workers in the neighborhoods who will reach out to people to make sure that they know what is available to help them, to make certain that they go see a doctor if they've reached a point where they need some help. There are a lot of ways to approach this, and we need some long-term solutions. But the immediate answer, I think, is a more intensive person-to-person effort in the neighborhoods affected.
As you know, there have also been significant clusters of cases of COVID-19 outbreaks in meatpacking or meat processing plants in Illinois, in towns like Rantoul and Monmouth and Joslin. Some have closed and reopened. I know you work summers at a pork processing plant in National City. You know what these places are like. Is it safe for Illinoisans to be returning to work at these plants?
I spent 12 months as a college student working my way through a packing plant, a Hunter Packing Company in East St. Louis, Illinois. So I saw it on the inside. It's hot, dirty, dangerous work. And it's reached the point where most of the people, or many of them, I should say, who are taking these jobs are immigrants. The Hispanic population, as well as Africans, coming into places like Beardstown and becoming a big part of the workforce. Well, now we're learning through hospital administrators in the area that they're seeing these COVID-19 infections increasing at these facilities and even deaths associated with it. So some of them had to close down. So many people were getting sick. And I've been talking to the owners of these plants about reopening and under what conditions. But it boils down to this. We worked then, and still people do, shoulder to shoulder, elbow to elbow, with a conveyor belt of meat or poultry coming right in front of you as fast as you can possibly react to it. It's just the nature of the workplace there. And secondly, it's a situation where many of those who work there, particularly those who are immigrants, live in group settings when they're not at work, travel all packed into the same car. Is just a natural breeding ground, I'm sorry to say, for this COVID-19 virus. So we talked, as I spoke to Dr. Redfield at CDC yesterday, one of the things we need to do is to make sure the plant itself tests employees before they come on the job to make sure they don't have a fever, to see if we can even have more testing. We also have to talk about some of their living conditions and alerting them to changes that need to be made.
So I know the Senate is, as I understand it, not working on another relief bill this week. But when that does happen, what is at the top of your list for the next federal move in this crisis?
Well, the job's not finished. You know, we set out and said initially, we're going to focus on unemployed Americans. And with 30 million of them or more, we certainly still have that responsibility. Secondly, we said, we're going to do what we can to keep small businesses alive during this period of downturn. And so we gave them forgivable loans. Now, all of those efforts I've just described in unemployment as well as the SBA loans are set to expire around July 1st. It's really wishful thinking to believe that our economy is going to be back and we're going to be out of the woods by July 1st. So we've got to maintain our commitment in these areas to unemployed and their families, as well as to helping small businesses. That's not the end of the list by any means. Testing is the thing that I'd say is critical at this moment. We're now in a debate in Illinois. When are we going to get back to business as usual? The governor has set some standards based on medical advice that he's received. There's a big controversy and debate over whether those standards are the right ones. But everything that we do from this point forward depends on testing, testing, and more testing, so that people coming on the job, coming into the schoolhouse, showing up in different places, have been tested to show that they're not positive.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're speaking with U.S. Senator Dick Durbin this morning. You know, you alluded a moment ago to the debate that's happening in Illinois about when and how to reopen. There has been growing resistance to Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home orders here, particularly in the less populous parts of downstate, where there have been fewer cases, or at least fewer, what would you say, test-confirmed cases. Do you think people have a point about reopening at least the more remote areas of Illinois?
I think they do, but let's be careful. In many areas, and you may have corrected yourself, whether there's been testing. Some of the rural areas have not shown a high incidence of infection because the question's never been asked. It's only when a person has advanced with the infection to the point where there's treatment that person enters into the records. But having said that, I think it's very clear that in urban areas like Chicago and New York, where there are more concentrated populations, we have a higher incidence of positive testing and death. So what the governor's suggested, and I think he's on the right track, is let's look at the state in terms of discrete regions and find out two things. First, what is the rate of infection and death? Is it increasing, flattened out, or decreasing? And we're looking for the downward slope, the decreasing. And secondly, what are the health resources that are available in each of these areas by way of hospitals and clinics and medical providers, ventilators, and the things that are essential? I think this is a tough call by the governor, but it's one that he's made based on medical advice, and that's what it should be.
We've seen in some states, as we're talking about reopening, offices and stores slowly reopening and demands from the government that workers stop taking unemployment, go back to work. But on the other hand, schools and daycare centers are remaining closed. And in fact, that's what Governor Pritzker's plan is here in Illinois. Offices and stores would reopen before schools and daycare centers, though we're not at that point yet. Is it right to demand parents go back to work without anywhere to send their kids?
That is a really tough situation. And I've heard from a lot of families who are concerned. First, they're worried about their kids falling behind in school. They have a new respect for teachers as they try to teach their kids at home. And they're in a predicament, too. If the kids don't go back to school or into daycare, how can they go back to work? And I think what the governor is trying to do is not to bring the children together into a circumstance where there might be an exchange of this infection from this virus. It's a hard call. There are no easy calls left on this. And I want to stick with him and make sure that we're doing this gradually and sensibly. But we've got to listen to the families, the working families, and the actual circumstances that they're facing.
And I also want to stay with Illinois for another moment, because I know last month, Illinois Senate President Don Harmon, State Senate President Don Harmon, wrote you asking for more than $40 billion for state and local government here. What do you think of his request?
Well, he sent the letter to us, and I talked to him personally afterwards. He's new to this position after Senator Cullerton's retirement, and I wish Don the best. It's a hard assignment on a good day, and our elected officials in the legislature have a particularly demanding agenda when it comes to this coronavirus. But I said to him, and I've said afterwards in other meetings, we shouldn't bring the word pension into this conversation. Every state, not every state, but most states have pension challenges. Certainly Illinois does. And for us to suggest that the help from the federal government would be used for pension relief is going nowhere in Washington. In fact, it's going to be used against us. I asked the governor point blank when we had a bipartisan congressional delegation conference call, are you asking for money for pensions for Illinois from the federal government? And he said, no, we're asking for the revenues that we've lost because of this COVID virus. And I said to him, I think that needs to be clear. Because of President Harmon's letter, I think many people seize the whole question, wait a minute, the federal government shouldn't be stepping in and bailing out pension problems in states. That is not what Governor Pritzker is asking for. That's not what I'm asking for. But when you look at the downturn in sales tax revenues, for example, in our state, you can see we're going to fall short of what we need. And look at the increased demands in our state for state services. We've got to make sure that our request in Washington is very clear.
Yeah, and even without the pension component of that, it's still $30 billion that President Harmon was asking for. And I've seen Governor Pritzker suggesting state revenues could fall short anywhere from $6 to $7 billion in the next fiscal year, this year and next year. Is there any sort of federal help on that scale on the way for Illinois?
There's a possibility. We did $150 billion in the CARES Act, which was the initial legislation about 6 weeks ago, $2.2 trillion. So $150 billion for local units of government. And it went to the state, to the cities and counties of more than 500,000 population. It didn't help the others. I think we need to return to it. Now, Senator McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, suggested a couple of weeks ago that the state and local governments ought to declare bankruptcy. Well, it exploded in his face. It was not a very smart suggestion. In fact, it was deadly when you consider the salaries that are needed for the police and the fire and the first responders who are risking their lives in the midst of this coronavirus epidemic. So he's kind of backed off of that. I hope that we can put together a bipartisan coalition for helping state and local governments. They're part of the team that we need to be strong in America to get through this.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. I also want to ask you, as we look ahead to the rest of this year, we are in an election year. And I wonder, are you comfortable running on a ticket with a presumptive presidential nominee who has been accused of sexual assault?
Well, I would say at this point, the accusation has been made and denied. And Joe Biden came forward and said, I want to turn loose all of my personnel records. If there's anything in there about this complainant, let the world see it. Be very public about it. But the archive said, we don't have that information. Then the Secretary of the Senate, where this event, apparently alleged event, may have taken place, said, we're not going to release this. We have our own restrictions. They're working that through at the court level. But what a different approach Joe Biden has taken to this. He didn't belittle his accuser. He didn't question whether she could raise this question. He instead said it didn't happen. It never happened. And I think the evidence ought to come up as best it can 27 years after the fact to show my side of the story. That's a much different approach than we've heard from others who face these accusations. So, yes, I'm supporting Joe Biden, and I believe it's time for a change here in Washington, and I hope he can lead us to change.
Do you believe Tara Reid?
You know, it's not a question of believing her at this point. I respect the right that she has to speak up, as we're learning with the Me Too movement and others. Many women who were victimized were frightened or for various reasons embarrassed and didn't come forward. We need to at least leave that opening for those who believe that they've been wronged to state their case on this. Whether she's right or wrong, true or false in her accusations, we may never know. But I think Joe Biden's approach to this has been as open as it can be, and he's denied the charges.
Last thing I want to ask you about, and it's on a slightly more personal note, you're back in Washington, D.C. now, but before that, I presume you were staying at home like most of us here in Springfield. I wonder, what has it been like to practice politics while in quarantine?
This is completely the opposite of my instincts as a political animal. A politician seeks crowds. We look for gatherings of people. We plow into these conversations with perfect strangers, shaking hands and getting to know people. I mean, that's just the nature of political discourse in America, and certainly I've been practicing it for a few years. So this is totally different. I will tell you that spending 5 weeks at home with my wife in Springfield, there were some very positive parts of that, too. I mean, we had a real neighborhood of activity. We had people walking around, waving to others, speaking from across the street, walking their dogs, riding their bikes, going into the park. I got to know the mailman a little better. I mean, these are things which just haven't happened in a long time. So as tough as it was to sit home day after day, there were some positive aspects to it.
How was your flight to D.C.?
It was a plane, American Airlines flight, about 180 seats, and there were 11 passengers and 6 crew members, counting the pilot and co-pilot. Nobody on the plane, obviously. And you can understand why these airlines are losing money. We were able to sit spaced out for the hour and a half flight. I called the attending physician and said, should I get in the car and drive 2 days, stay overnight somewhere, or get on this plane for an hour and a half? He said, slap your mask on and get on the plane. It's better.
Senator Dick Durbin is the senior U.S. Senator for the state of Illinois. Senator Durbin, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on the 21st.
Good talking to you too, Brian. Thanks.
More to come on the 21st after a short break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. With our schedules upended and the stress of a global pandemic, sleep, so critical to our physical and mental health, has become more elusive. Or maybe you're sleeping more now and also dreaming more vividly. One study from France actually found that participants reported a 35% increase in dream recall since the start of the pandemic. Here's some tape from 8-year-old Max in Des Plaines recalling one of his recent quarantine dreams.
I had a dream that I was cutting my hair, and I cut the whole top off, and I was bald, and I was cutting it with snippers.
I think an 8-year-old with a friar tuck qualifies as a nightmare, but that's just me. Today on the show, we want to talk about sleep during the pandemic, how to sleep better, how and why sleep habits have changed. We're joined by Dr. James Wyatt. He's the founding president of the Illinois Sleep Society and is director of the Section of Sleep Disorders and Sleep-Wake Research at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. He's also a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Rush Medical College. He specializes in the treatment of insomnia and circadian rhythm sleep disorders. Dr. Wyatt, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. Very happy to be joining you today.
And as always, we want to hear from you. Give us a call. Tell us how you're sleeping or if you have a question for Dr. Wyatt. The number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, our number is 800-222-9455. So, Dr. Wyatt, our producer mentioned that at the bottom of your email signature is a motto, losing sleep loses lives. Don't be a loser. And It gives the impression that you think sleep is pretty important. So before we get to why people are having such a hard time sleeping now, like, you know, a global pandemic, can you tell us what happens to the body during a typical good night's sleep?
Sure. There's sort of this misperception that a sleeping body and a sleeping brain are relatively inert, and couldn't be further from the truth. We have an extremely active brain and body, but it's converting to different things. So much of your body is converting to restorative processes during sleep, spending a lot more energy devoted to digestion, tissue repair, nervous system building and rebuilding, memory processing and consolidation. So there's a lot of housekeeping tasks going on during sleep. It's actually, in fact, quite active. Now, that being said, one of the key linkages here as well is between sleep and the immune system. So we know that a healthy sleeper who's getting somewhere between, let's say for an adult, between 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night, that helps the immune system boost its functioning. So during the current pandemic, that's one of the things we were absolutely think is essential, is everyone trying to devote sufficient time for sleep.
So are there people who are just better at sleeping, maybe genetically or for some other reason, and other people are prone to insomnia? I mean, we hear these terms, early birds, night owls. With, you know, as a night owl, I feel like I get a bit of a bad rap on that. What is the science behind that?
Sure. There's a tremendous amount of science. There's 40 to 50 years of sleep science here that we can impart. So there are differences in terms of what we call chronotype. You'd mentioned the early morning birds and the night owls. That can be to some extent inherited. It can also be a developmental thing. So for example, if you look at teenagers and those in their 20s, most of them will tend to be more along the night owl spectrum. And then there's sort of a neutral position that happens in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then as you enter older adulthood, it's more common to be an early bird, if you will, you know, going to bed earlier and waking up earlier. So some of that will influence the optimal timing of sleep and alertness. But there are also individuals who are more prone and vulnerable to getting insomnia. So in a given year, not this current year when things are highly abnormal, but in a traditional given year, about 3 out of 10 adults will experience a short-term bout of insomnia. And at any given time, about 10% of the adult population has been suffering from insomnia on a chronic basis, meaning difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, and some daytime consequence to it that it's gone on for longer than 3 months at a time. But I want to make sure that we're very careful to distinguish those who have an insufficient ability to sleep, those with insomnia. That's very different from those who have an insufficient amount of sleep because they're not in bed long enough trying to sleep. So those are people who are sleep deprived on, if you will, a voluntary basis because they're staying up too late or getting up too early and not devoting enough time for sleep. What's fascinating is
you're speaking directly to my soul here. I want you to know.
What's fascinating, those with insomnia, those who are in bed a sufficient amount of time but have difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, that seems to be accompanied by much more minor, if you will, long-term health consequences. Now, there are some that are quite serious. So we know, for example, that if you have insomnia on a chronic basis, it more than doubles your risk for developing depression at some point. And depression itself can bring significant morbidity and mortality. But those who, in fact, who are not in bed long enough, who are sleep deprived, that carries the much greater risk. That's where my motto of, you know, losing sleep loses lives. We know that this dramatically increases not just immune system compromise, but risks of accidents and injuries, things like falling asleep driving the car.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. We're speaking with Dr. James Wyatt, professor and director at the Rush University Medical Center Section of Sleep Disorders and Sleep-Wake Research. We're talking about sleep during the coronavirus pandemic, and many of us may have trouble sleeping now or having particularly vivid stress dreams. You can call and share your thoughts with us or questions for Dr. Wyatt at 800-222. That's 800-222-9455. So I understand your research is actually part of the reason that airline pilots have mandatory sleep times now, according to FAA regulations that were implemented a few years ago. And I mean, it seems that what happens while we're sleeping during, if we're ideally getting that 7 to 9 hours, or maybe if we're getting less, I mean, that affects how we're feeling the next day, whether we're an airline pilot or a public radio host.
Right. So there are a lot of, if you will, alertness critical jobs out there. So, for example, not just our healthcare workers on the front lines who are working long hours and overnights, but if you look at airline pilots, long-haul truck drivers who are delivering critical food and supplies across the country right now. So a lot of these occupations where alertness equals safety. For those individuals, there's a certain number of hours in a row that one can maintain optimal alertness before it starts to get compromised. And it gets compromised much faster when somebody is trying to stay awake and alert working at night. There's a biological 24-hour clock in the brain called the circadian system that is actively impairing our alertness at night because it's actively trying to keep us asleep. And therefore, that's why we have a much harder time trying to stay up in the middle of the night doing an occupation or, you know, let's say college or high school students trying to study in the middle of the night, cramming before an exam. So we're biologically programmed to be a diurnal species, a day active, night sleeping species.
So let's get from the sort of general situation with sleep to the more specific one we might be in now because of a global pandemic. We've been hearing people reporting difficulty sleeping. How does something like the COVID-19 pandemic affect our ability to sleep?
Well, I think one of the things that's been fascinating over the last 2 months is seeing in my own clinic and those of my colleagues how diverse the responses have been in sleep to this COVID pandemic. So, for example, there are some patients who've told me their sleep is actually starting to improve because of stay-at-home orders. All of a sudden, now they're not facing a 1 to 2 hour commute per day, the stresses that might be encountered with a coworker in the workplace. So for some individuals, there's actually been a positive benefit for sleep. Now, that being said, I think that's the minority. So many of my patients have been reporting dramatic increases in stress from multiple factors, not just worry and concern about the virus itself, but also concerns about job security, the difficulties in learning how to do some work at home things, but also, you know, dovetailing with what Senator Durbin was mentioning recently, this added stress of those being at home and also, you know, trying to work at home, but also trying to act like a teacher at home, taking care of kids who have closed schools and where there may be, you know, some education going on online, but there's a dramatically increased demand on the parents to multitask, jumping back and forth between monitoring the kids and doing work. So a lot of these factors can increase stress levels during the day.
Yeah.
Coupled with that, there's a dramatic decrease in physical activity level for a lot of people, being afraid to go out, the gyms are closed, parks are closed, places where people might normally exercise. So we have the decrease in activity level. Also being inside a lot decreases our sunlight exposure, and we need to have sunlight at regular times during the day to keep our brain's 24-hour clock lined up with the sleep schedule. So there's been a lot of threats to healthy sleep happening just because of the pandemic.
This is Dr. James Wyatt. He's a professor of sleep disorders and sleep-wake research. We have a caller on the line, Caitlin from Freeport, gave us a call at 800-222-9455. She's working two essential jobs and says she's sleeping great. Caitlin, what's your question for Dr. Wyatt?
Well, I just feel like since I now, good morning, everyone.
Good
morning. Now that I'm working 7 days a week and working two essential jobs, I should be stressed out enough to the point where my sleep is interrupted, but I'm getting really good sleep and I'm not dreaming at all. And I think that's very strange. I was wondering what that was all about.
Sure, Caitlin. So great question there. Let's take the dreaming part first. Remembering dreams in the morning actually doesn't correlate with good or bad sleep. So it's one of these myths that's out there that somehow, I must not be sleeping well because I'm not dreaming. So don't sweat that part. But another thing that may be going on is I imagine there's a fair amount of physical exhaustion going on working 7 days per week and not having a whole lot of downtime. So to some extent, sleep may be a refuge. But another thing is working two essential jobs. If you look compared to others who have, let's say, very low job security, maybe you have a higher sense of control over what's going on right now because you are in demand. You are doing things of value. And oftentimes that can calm the mind when getting into bed because you say, hey, I've put in a hard day's work. I've done something essential.
All right, Caitlin, thank you so much for calling us today. And remember, you can also join the conversation if you're listening now at 800-222-9455. Doctor, we also got an email from a listener. And speaking of dreams, right? And we've heard that people are having maybe dreams that are a little more crazy or even just a little more vivid during this pandemic. We got an email from a listener at talk@21stshow.org. Katie says, quote, I've had a mix of scary and pleasant vivid dreams. Yesterday, I was swimming with dolphins in a tropical paradise. I was really sad when my alarm woke me up. Dr. Wyatt, what is our body doing when we're dreaming?
So there's a lot of controversy actually about what a dream is for. So there are some theories that imbue dreams with a lot of psychological significance, talking about resolving conflicts or wish fulfillment. The more recent 20 years of research, though, really points to dreams as being a place where the mind is working on memory consolidation and processing. So, for example, oftentimes the content of dreams will feature things that happened to you today, the day before you went to bed, in combination with things that were fairly similar to it in years past. But one of the things that happens with dreams, especially later in the night, okay, so let's say the last third of your night, dreams tend to get a lot more vivid, a lot more bizarre, and a lot more active. But one of the things that happens during the dreaming state is that our frontal lobes, okay, and that's the front part of your brain that controls things like logic and planning and inhibition, those are largely inactive, so you don't have much focus going on. You're not bringing logic to these. That's why we think the bizarreness characteristics can happen. So one of the factors that I'm concerned about is with more people reporting more dreams. Oftentimes, if you're reporting more dreams, what if, and it's sudden change, for example, in your sleep, what if that means your sleep is becoming a little more fragmented? Because perhaps you're sleeping at different times than you normally would have, or you're under greater stress, or maybe there are more people in the home as, let's say, college kids have come back to home. So it's not always a good sign to have more dreams.
Yeah,
but
it's interesting.
I'm one of the people who doesn't necessarily believe that there's a big psychological significance to them.
Okay, so we won't read too much into the dolphins in the paradise, but one of our producers shared with me this ongoing study from the Lyon Neuroscience Research Center in France, which found that the pandemic has caused a 35% increase in dream recall among participants since March. So I guess that does go to your point about maybe there is something going on with sleep that would shown there.
Right. We also see increases in nightmares. Anytime you look at things, let's say we're talking rocket attacks experienced by residents in the Middle East, or after earthquakes, or after hurricanes, there is enough science of sleep during those events and shortly afterward to show that there are these transient spikes, not just in the vividness of dreams, but in nightmares. And the good thing is a lot of these tend to be stress-related and will tend to resolve on their own. But I think any time that somebody has had experience of difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep or nightmares or things that have gone on more than a couple of weeks, that's the time to try to go get some help. Primary care doctors are a terrific first place to start. And one of the things that we're doing during the pandemic is trying to release the guidelines a little bit. We're trying to be a little more flexible. For example, if somebody needs a sleeping pill for a couple of weeks, a lot of my primary care doctor friends are saying they've had a big spike in patients calling for those. We're much more liberal now saying, absolutely, if you need a sleeping pill for the next couple of weeks and their risk-benefit ratio is favorable, absolutely, let's do that. Hmm. Or, for example, there's this advice, in general, try to make your bed a place that's relaxing where you're not reading and you're not watching TV, you're not listening to music. But during the next couple of weeks to a couple of months, if during periods of extreme stress you're having trouble shutting that mind off, it's not the worst thing in the world to stream a little Netflix or to read a fiction novel to help you wind down and focus your brain to be able to fall asleep.
Yeah, and so we've only got about a minute left in that. I mean, you're kind of touching on what I would last thing I hope to ask you about, which is, how can we shut off our anxious minds? I mean, there are good reasons that people are anxious now. Right. And again, just in about a little less than a minute, what can we do to shut that off?
One of the key things, especially with a lot of people being sheltered in place at home, is that they may be attending school at home where it used to be in the outside world, or they're working from home and it used to be in the outside world. We've got to reestablish some boundaries so that there's some winding down time before you try to hop into bed. Make sure that there's a time when you shut off the work mode and turn on the relaxation mode. Read a good book, listen to some music, have a pleasant phone call, watch a TV show that's pleasant. Do something that helps you wind down. And when you get into bed, that's when you try to experience good sleep hygiene. Trying to have a fairly consistent bedtime and wake-up time, sufficient number of hours in bed, nice, dark, quiet, cool bedroom. Those are the kind of things one can certainly control.
Dr. James Wyatt is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and director of sleep medicine and sleep disorders at Rush University Medical Center. Dr. Wyatt, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us on the 21st, and I hope you get some good rest tonight.
Thanks, Brian. Everyone stay safe.
More to come after a short break. We're going to be talking with booksellers, checking in about how they're adapting during the pandemic and if they have any recommendations for reading for us. That's coming up in just a moment. Stay with us. This is the 21st. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past few weeks, local businesses have been having to figure out how to keep their doors open while also maintaining social distancing during the stay-at-home order. And that's even if they were a business that was allowed to be open. For many small businesses, that's meant moving their services online or offering curbside pickup. That's no different for Illinois booksellers. The once tactile and visual experience of wandering into your local bookstore is on hold for now. But nevertheless, store owners have been finding different ways to connect with readers across Illinois. Liz Asbury is the owner of Bob's Bay, a used book and media store in downtown Bloomington. I also have Susie Takis with me. She's the owner of The Bookseller in the Lincoln Square neighborhood of Chicago. They're both joining me via Zoom. Liz, Susie, welcome to the 21st.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And we also have John Alexander on the line with us from Verdon, where he and his wife, Jeannie, own Books on the Square. John, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Brian.
And we also want to hear from you, too. What have you been reading these days? How have you been getting your books? Is there a local bookstore in your community that you'd like to highlight? Give us a call if you want to join our conversation. 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. Liz, I want to start with you. Can you tell me a little bit more about your store, Bob's Bay in Bloomington?
Yeah, definitely. So we are, you know, we sell a lot of used books, and obviously you want to, like you said, you want to come in and touch the books and look at them before you, you know, purchase them. That's what makes used bookstore or bookstores in general great. You know, you can't have that with the internet. And so, yeah, we've just been adapting in different ways. It's been hard, but we've sort of switched things on over to Facebook, to sell items, and it's been working pretty well, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of mix? You mentioned used books. Is it new and used, or mostly antiquarian? What sort of mix of books do you sell?
So we do sell antiquarian books, but used, as in you know, previously owned. I guess I would say like it could have been a bestseller last year, and now we have it. So
sure.
But yeah, I don't really care many new books.
Okay. And John, I understand you sell rare and used books mainly. Can you give people a sense of what they would normally see when they walk into Books on the Square? What kind of titles do you specialize in?
Sure, Brian. We do new, used, and rare, primarily used and rare, and mostly used too, I would say. Maybe 60-70% used, maybe 10-20% rare, and another 10% maybe new. We like Lincoln, Illinois history, and the Civil War, but we have a little bit of everything in five buildings, four in Verdon and one in downtown Springfield.
And Susie, what about the bookseller? It's actually a cafe, I understand, right? I imagine under different circumstances, it sounds like a nice place to sit down and enjoy a book with a cup of coffee. Susie, all right, we seem to be having a technical problem with Susie. So, John, I'm going to stick with you for a moment. You told one of our producers that usually 90% of your customers are in-store. How have you had to adjust your business under the stay-at-home order?
Well, Brian, we've always sold books online, primarily on the large used book sites, Amazon and Abe Books, abebooks.com. And for some 25 years, maybe selling online, that has generated about, I would say, 20 to 25% of our overall business. But here in the last month or two, we've really come to depend on online sales, and that's now jumped to probably the great bulk of our business. And actually, we've been pretty busy online. We had our best month ever online in April. So we want to stay hot online to make up for lost sales coming through the door.
And so it sounds like you said, it's been a pretty busy month for internet sales. I understand we have Susie back with us now. Susie, the bookseller, I was saying a moment ago, it's actually a cafe, right? Can you tell me a little bit about your business?
Sure. It's a bookstore, and like you said, with a cafe. And in the usual fashion, we would have light fare like coffee drinks, wine, beer, sandwiches. We hosted a lot of events and book groups that would meet in the cafe and enjoy each other there. And then since the business had to close, there's no longer cafe sales. We are allowed to sell wine to go, so we can sell bottles of wine. That was tricky in April because there was no curbside pickup. But now that May, the governor has allowed curbside pickup, we have online sales, we have pickup sales, and we still have been doing some delivery. So one way or the other, we can get someone their book.
Yeah, and I understand you've created or maybe you've had already, a subscription program that people can sign up for. How does that work?
We did. It's called Bookseller Selects, and we've had it for about 2 years now, but it's just gained most recently more popularity. And you can buy a 6-month or 12-month subscription for adult paperback or children's board books. So it'd be a great gift for a christening gift or a baby shower gift. But by far the most popular has been the 6-month paperback adult version. And I just choose a book that I really have enjoyed, and I wrap it and I write a little note in the book why I enjoyed the book, and then I send it off.
Liz, what about you? Can you tell us more about mystery grab bags you've made?
Yeah, so we started doing grab bags, which is something we've never done before, and the reception was pretty good. Basically, it's just themed topics. So say there'll be a fiction, just a general fiction grab bag, or I just sold a zombie-themed books grab bag. Just sort of make fun little themes, I guess. And those sales have been going well. I think it's fun just like open up a present, you know, a surprise, even if you bought it yourself.
Yeah.
I've
had that experience. I bought a used book online once, and it came wrapped in the most beautiful. It looked like inside of a hardback, the end papers, of a Victorian, you know, it was wrapped, and it felt like, yeah, even though I paid for it, it was a nice present. Yeah, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the 21st. We've been speaking with Illinois booksellers Liz Asbury, Susie Tuckus, and John Alexander about how their businesses have had to adjust during the stay at home order. In just a moment, we're going to hear about what they're reading now. But if you have a question for the experts about what you should read next, please give us a call, 800-222-9455, or share your thoughts with us on Twitter at 21STShow. John tweeted us, who said, I happened to start Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine this week, or the week it all began, I should say. He goes on to say, it describes the way corporations use disasters as opportunities to steal from the public. It was written almost a decade ago, but seems to have accurately predicted our current crisis. So again, if you have a question or want to share a book recommendation, 800-222-9455, or tweet us at 21STShow. All right, I want to get to what you are reading now. John, I'm going to start with you. You told one of our producers that Little Women by Louisa May Alcott made your list. Can you talk more about what gives this story such staying power and why it made your list?
Well, that's a good question, Brian. I mean, here's a book that was written in 1868 and 69, originally in two volumes, that has survived for about 150 years now. I noticed in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch just a week or two ago in the Sunday paper, the book section, that it was still on the top 10 list in St. Louis, probably as a result of a recent movie about the book. But it's a timeless story about a family trying to hunker down and survive the Civil War crisis, much like we're trying to hunker down and survive the coronavirus crisis.
And Liz, you just finished Full Throttle by Joe Hill. That's actually Stephen King's son. Does Hill follow in his father's footsteps with the suspense and horror genre?
He does. Yeah, I would say, you know, this might be a little bit of a debate, but I think he might be better than Stephen King.
Ooh, fighting you words.
Know, yeah, I know. But yeah, it was great. It was, you know, a mix of different types of horror genres, which was really refreshing to see in a mix of short stories. You know, there were some like sci-fi ones, some like, I guess, true horror, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's what you'd consider it. It was really great. Yeah, and now I'm reading a graphic novel about David Bowie, which is quite a change.
Is there a specific genre you like for this time when we're staying at home, many of us anyway?
You know, I would say read what's comfortable for you right now. Don't pressure yourself into reading something you have no interest in.
Yeah.
Like, you might want to read the, you know, 100 best books of the century, but...
Yeah,
you know, some of those books.
I have that aspiration. I also have this book on killer germs sitting on my desk that I feel like I should read, but yet have not been able to bring myself to. Yeah. Susie, I wonder, are there any books that you want to put on our radar for listeners?
Sure, you might enjoy a new a debut book by a local author, Elizabeth Wetmore. It's called Valentine, and her book was our first virtual launch event that we did, and it's a story set in West Texas, and it begins with Gloria Rodriguez is attacked by a man she left with, and then each chapter is told from the point of view of a different woman or girl in the town, and it just alternates between all those different voices. And it's really a wonderful story and really well done.
So, Susie, I would imagine that like a lot of us, you've had to adjust a lot, as we've heard, over the past couple months, not just in your business, but in life. And I think we can look around and we feel this expectation of productivity, right? People are baking sourdough. They're painting the house, reading Proust. While on the other hand, a lot of us are just trying to keep our heads above water. I wonder, have you even had time to read?
Yeah, I fall in the head above water category. I start the day, I usually walk my dog, and then I pick up Abby, who is at the store working with me, and we work. And then we leave around, I don't know, between 6, 6:30, and then I'll deliver books for an hour, 2 hours, depending. And then... So that's what we've been doing day by day. It's just hard to keep up. Most places are closed by the time I get home, things that I need. So it's important for us to recharge and have our Saturday and Sunday. So we're trying to be flexible for customers and available for customers at the same time as being able to keep my head from spinning.
Yeah. And we've only got a couple of minutes left, but Liz and John, I wonder if you have felt that way as well. Liz, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I definitely also am. I feel like I'm maybe treading water at this moment. You know, things have sort of, I've gotten used to the craziness of everyday life now. That's why I actually chose the book of short stories, because I can just, you know, it's a quick little thing. I don't really have to remember what happened, you know. When I finished reading it a couple days ago, I think all booksellers are very busy in general. We wear many hats. And honestly, sometimes we don't have a lot of time to read. So I'm taking this opportunity to read some books that were sitting around. So.
And John, last question to you, and we've only got about a minute left here, but I wonder, in stressful times like this, what kind of comfort can reading provide?
Well, I like to read things for fun, Brian, and just to give you an idea of some recent things, I got a big kick out of a book by Andrew Schaefer called Hope Never Dies. It's a, if you can believe this, a Joe Biden, Barack Obama detective team solving crimes. I thought it was a, kind of a fun little read. I've had a good time with a book by Steve Barry calling titled The Lincoln Myth, a book about Abe Lincoln and Brigham Young. These are, that's a historical fiction piece. I kind of favor them. And then recently I've also read and enjoyed Andrew Greeley, The Priestly Sins, and another Illinois writer, David Ellis, The Hidden Man.
Sure. All right. Well,
DJ Box is a good one, I think, to read, a national writer.
All right. Well, so many recommendations. We're going to have to leave it there. We will have links to all of the businesses we've been talking to today. And I want to thank everyone for joining us. Susie Takas from The Bookseller in Chicago, John Alexander from Books on the Square in Springfield and Verdon, and Liz Asbury from Bob's Bay Books in Bloomington. Again, we will have links to all those bookstores on our website. Some of them have GoFundMe campaigns. And I'm afraid that is all the time we have for this week. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you on Monday.